everyone, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Daily Friend podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sarah Gahn. Sarah, how are you?
Well, thank you. Bit chilly, and you?
I'm pretty much the same. And Gabriel, how are you? Are you in Joburg? Where are you currently?
I'm in Joburg. I've come to the office to shoot this podcast because I'm not only being load shed at home, the power cable's been ripped out from the box in the street, so I'm totally powerless. Very excited to have some electricity here in the office.
What fun times we live in. Yes. So speaking of those fun times, let's get right into discussing the lockdown. Last night, of course, we had an announcement by the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who announced some sort of minor and major changes to our lives once again by diktat. The first was that alcohol was once again going to be banned on the justification that basically people were injuring and stabbing and fighting with each other too much and driving cars drunk into each other. And it was filling up the hospitals, and we need to ban alcohol until the peak of the virus has passed. And that went into effect from today. Apparently the regulations were promulgated very quickly behind the scenes yesterday. And I believe they're coming into effect today. Parks are sort of being opened, but Sarah has some complicating aspects on that. We've got a curfew back from 9 until, I think it's 4 in the morning, so people aren't allowed out at night. There's going to allegedly be more enforcement of mask wearing with legal sanction for people who don't wear masks in certain places. Family visits will remain banned, although it's not clear how exactly that's going to be policed. And taxis have been confirmed to be allowed to operate at full capacity, which sort of goes in the face of most of the other stuff that's going on. Gabriel, you have thoughts. You have some esteem economy thoughts about how this is how the Ramaphosa's speech last night. Why don't you tell us what you've been thinking?
Yeah. So people who've been reading the Daily Friend, big ups to you. Will be familiar with this idea. There are three basic social goods that people pursue. One is property, one is power, and the other one is prestige, or the positive regard of others, or esteem. And that is hugely important to thinking about the COVID-19, the plague. The reason for this is that one of the things that you want a population to do in order to combat the virus is take on voluntary behaviors, or take on behaviors that are very difficult to police, like mask wearing, social distancing, hand sanitizing. It's sort of hard to imagine.
Families.
Exactly. It's hard to imagine a government that's going to go around and fine people for not washing their hands. You kind of need something else to do that. You can't rely on the power, pure power, coercive force side of things. You need a lot of the esteem market to work. This is why I wrote in the Daily Friend several times about the call-up. The call-up being sort of an alternative idea to the lockdown, where you have some government regulations, most important probably being border control, and you have, you know, some bans on large gatherings, maybe closures of schools, maybe this or that, but you leave businesses open, you leave people free to elect, to go to restaurants, do what they like, but you send a strong message from scientists through the authority of government to say, you know, this is a serious disease. We don't want our hospital system to be overwhelmed. Please, please be careful. Please change your behavior. Now, the reason that I was excited by the call-up model is that I looked at countries that had done the best job of saving lives and livelihoods. Almost all of these countries are in the Far East. Almost all of these countries are completely overlooked in mainstream media outlets in South Africa, in the UK, and in the US, in the Anglosphere. When they think about the Far East, they think about China, which used the iron boot lockdown. But the countries that really did best, Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Vietnam, to name just a few, they either used no lockdown at all or had very, very brief lockdowns, and mainly relied on call-up, sort of combination of light regulation and voluntary social mobilization. Now, I felt that one of the dangers of the lockdown was that we'd already initiated a call up a week before that with this declaration of a state of disaster, and every leader in parliament saying, you know, we echo Ramaphosa's call, please, please tell Africans to change your behavior, please be careful. And we closed international borders. And you could see from Google mobility data, you could see from testing data, insofar as it was reliable, that this had a very real effect. And then we had the lockdown. And as soon as we hit the lockdown, it's as if we forgot the call up side of things. Now what's happened is we ended the lockdown, not because it worked, but precisely because it didn't work. We continue to have exponential growth throughout the lockdown. South Africa is blessed and cursed with low life expectancy. So a lot of people die already before they get old enough to be in the highest risk factor for COVID. So we've got a lower infection fatality rate than older countries. But nevertheless, our deaths have been climbing exponentially throughout the lockdown and ever since at the same sort of rate. And now we're starting to hit panic mode, because now we are getting to the point where there is very serious concern about hospitals being overwhelmed. What do we do? Well, what we should do is continue the call up. And just by the way, the esteem economy kind of principles suggest very strongly that you don't need the government to keep repeating itself. You know, if it's got its slogan, it's got its slogan, and it can do its little 2-minute thing at the start of a speech, say, you know, please just a reminder to everyone to wear your masks and socially distance. The point of the call up is that once it becomes a norm, which it largely has in parts of the country, people voluntarily encourage each other. They shame people who don't adhere to the norms. They encourage people who do adhere to the norms. You don't need the government to keep doing that. What you do need the government to do is help out at pinch points and crisis points, at petri dishes for viral spread, where it's difficult for people to be in control of the thing themselves. For example, taxis. This is partly why it's so disappointing that the government wasted so much money. I mean, probably it's going to add up to more than R1 trillion by having a 2.5 effective hard lockdown. And so it doesn't find itself in a position where it can subsidize private transport to keep guys competitive at 50% capacity, or to allow market forces to operate. And if you're going to not subsidize them and they're going to go at 50% capacity, for them to then just charge twice as much. They won't do the latter because that's too much like capitalism, and they can't afford to do the former because they've already looted and broken the fiscal, you know, the fiscal cupboard is not just bare, it's broken. So we're in this impossible position where ordinary South Africans don't always have control over their circumstances and aren't being particularly helped out. But now what's happened from last night, and it happened today, I've just been watching SABC News for the last 2 hours with a minister, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the Minister of Justice, and Jackson Mthembu, all talking about how we should deal with this. And they very much use the language of the economy of esteem. You know, we need owners to encourage others, shame people who don't comply. The Minister of Justice literally said it must be cool to wear a mask. It must be embarrassing to be seen outside not wearing a mask. This is exactly correct understanding of how the esteem economy should work, to normalize. This is the word that they like to use. And it's the correct word, to normalize a new kind of behavior. But what Ramaphosa has done is he has weaponized the call up. Instead of harnessing it to encourage better behavior, he's weaponizing it to shame all South Africans. He said last night, everyone who's caught this disease has caught it because of recklessness. Now, that's just factually not true, but it's a way of taking the latent panic and anger and frustration around the fact that so much time was bought for government to prepare the healthcare system to be able to take a bit of extra strain, for government to think smartly about how it can manage pinch points, how it can use the lightest possible regulation to get the most bang for buck. And that hasn't happened. And so there is a lot of anger around. And Ramaphosa puts a big mirror up and says, no, it's not me, it's you. Everyone that's died, it's your fault. You, as South Africans, have been reckless. Anyone who's had a drink is somehow to blame for this thing. And so you get this moral, self-righteous kind of almost vindictive surprise overnight regulation. Not like, okay, guys, we're worried about the booze thing. We are going to re-implement a booze ban, but you've got a few days to go and stock up if you like. It's like, this is a very punitive rap on the knuckles. And it feels very boarding school. It feels very much like the housemaster has found out that some boy made a poo in the common room in some protest or did some antisocial thing. And now the whole boarding house is not allowed to go home for the next 3 weekends and see their family. Surprise, surprise. And you folks must learn your lesson. It's childish. It's immature. It's not helpful. And all that it's doing, as far as I can tell, I went around Yeovil this morning trying to buy some booze, and I have managed to find plenty of guys who are very eager to sell some. I spoke to some people, and they're just very, very frustrated at the unraveling of the social fabric, at the untrustworthiness of our administrators, and at the matronizing attitude with which South African citizens and residents are being dealt. And I think that the one of the deep crises is when you screw around with the esteem economy like this, when you abuse it like this, and when you weaponize it as is being done. And as has been done, by the way, 10-year lockdown is a very good phrase that Anthea Jeffrey's been talking about. You know, this lockdown didn't just start the other day. One of the things that's been happening for the last decade is weaponizing the esteem economy in terms of race baiting. So that, you know, there's this army of government stenographers called journalists who will shame anyone who stands up and says that someone in the ANC is corrupt. And they'll say, oh, you must be a racist, or you must be a pimpy, or you must be like an Uncle Tom to think that there's corruption, or to think that the BEE programs are incentivizing rent-seeking behavior, or to think that cadre deployment is really just a self-serving exercise that impoverishes most South Africans but serves an elite. You know, all of the ways that the ANC has managed to stay in power or stay popular in the press, at least over the last decade, have been by weaponizing the esteem economy. But now COVID was something new, and it looked like we might break into a new conversation, and the IQ might lift, and we might drop our old habits. And we have dropped our old habits. We're just replacing them with even worse ones, even worse kind of childish high school type kind of paternalism. And I think that it makes it difficult for people to trust each other. It makes it difficult for people to trust their administration. And that kind of breakdown, you know, the latent effects that has can last for many, many years, because things like trust especially are much easier to break than they are to rebuild.
Very well said. Sara, your thoughts? You've also had some complications on the parks opening front.
Yes. Can I first just give some concrete examples to exactly what Gabriel has said? Ramaphosa has done it every time he's given a speech. He's given us a long spiel, the same spiel every time about, you know, wearing masks, how we touch, where we put things, how much times we wash our hands, etc. And that's part of that patronizing sort of teacher-pupil quality. The other thing, and this is, goes to the 10-year lockdown, is that if a lot of people are not being reckless, but they're living in situations that make – they are cramped, and that make the likelihood of spread greater, because the mismanagement of the country has meant that there has been less house building, fewer proper townships being or suburbs being established, many more people creating squatter camps. And so this is really that adds to the insult of the whole thing. And I feel very strongly about it. The other thing that, before I get to the parks, is that you notice how no one's mentioned the fact that they still haven't done anything about cigarettes. No. Cigarettes, I don't think were mentioned, unless I missed it. And then the parks. And my son is a trail runner, and he is now hanging from the ceiling because he doesn't know what to do with himself, because 4 parks are not yet open because they are deemed to be nature reserves. And that is the Botanical Garden in Roodepoort, the Imirinsha Dam in Imirinsha, Klipfurfuurspruit, and Kloofendal in on the West Rand. Now, a couple of them are biggish, but the other two are parks. They are in the middle of the city. And there is absolutely no rationale for distinguishing them. The rationale they were given is that, well, they know, and we've got to get PPE equipment for our staff, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, one's reaction is, you're jerking us around, and why haven't you got the PPE stuff? Already, this was coming. The court had judged against this. So there's, you get the feeling that as a public, you are being jerked around. And I don't know if it's complete just coincidence, but I had a little drive out today to meet someone for coffee. And it actually occurred to me that fewer people, and people have been very good about wearing their masks in the street, in fact, better than they need to be. There are very few people wearing masks in the street today that I could see. So I agree. I mean, never mind esteem. Right now, I think we hold our government in such such disrespect. They can't tell us to do anything actually anymore.
Yeah. So I think just one of the things about esteem to underline is that it can seem like I'm sort of being a bit wishy-washy or namby-pamby. But I think that and part of the problem is that so much of the language of esteem has been monopolized effectively by the left, and not just in this country. So talking about normalizing new normals, social mobilization, that all sounds very left, unless you look at South Korea and Singapore, where you've got very centrist or right-wing, center-right governments who are, you know, keen on triggering it and then letting it play out. But one of the reasons, you know, one of the most common phrases that the left likes to use is the narrative, owning the narrative or controlling the narrative. And there is a good point there that we shouldn't surrender to we as centrists should not surrender to them. And the good point is that people's estimations of various sort of more granular aspects get subsumed often by broader us-them kind of dichotomies. And until now, the grandest sort of narrative in the ANC's favor has been everything that's wrong is because of apartheid. And as long as that was a conceptual tool that could be deployed, it would always be deployed to excuse their own failures and resist accountability. Now, it has been starting to wear a little bit thin after 25 years, and we've had to add some personnel changes, replace Zuma with Ramaphosa, so you've got a new face in a business suit so that you have some promise of new reforms regardless of the actual no reforms. But something has happened. The whole world has changed, and every South African feels how important government is in their life, because every South African now knows either directly themselves or someone immediately around them who has lost a job, who hasn't been able to work, who's lost an income, who's somehow been screwed around by government. And so there is, this is potentially a time for a great rethink about why are we so cramped? Why do we have such terrible housing? Why do we have so much unemployment going into this? Why do we have so much debt going into this? Why is it that our government is so inept that it can't flip and get more than two ambulances in Port Elizabeth? Like, what is going on here? We need a change. But the counter argument is going to be that now everything that isn't to blame on apartheid is to blame on a combination of an invisible enemy virus, which is its own thing. If it only kills 4,000 people, that won't matter. Every other death will be attributable to it too. And the other thing is reckless South Africans who don't do it as they're told. And in France's scenario planning, one of the things that he's always distinguished is between this idea of left-right in terms of being more fiscally austere or more government spending versus like an authoritarian or a liberal attitude towards government rule. And the thing to fear has always been that as the ANC gets onto its last legs, because it's proven itself incapable over and again of running a clean administration, it then resorts to the iron fist of command in order to retain control. And this feels to me very much like a move in that direction. It feels like a commitment to blaming everyone else, including the citizenry. And when you start blaming the citizenry, when you start saying, citizens, you are all to blame for what's happening, it almost sounds refreshing, because it's not the kind of thing you hear very often in this country coming from leadership. But the flip side of it is, and we with our boots and our guns and the butts of our guns, we will beat you into shape if we need to, because there are lives on the line here. And that feels very concerning to me for the 10 years to come, because there's going to be more anger if pensions are taken, which it looks very much like they're going to be. If land is taken without compensation, which it looks increasingly like is something that's going to happen. There are going to be many South Africans that are very unhappy about this. And it feels like we're entering into a more authoritarian rhetoric, on the back of one of the most authoritarian lockdowns, with very bizarre authoritarian things about parks and open-toed shoes and cigarettes and all that kind of stuff. And I don't think it bodes well for the future. But it'll be supported by the grand narrative of blaming the virus and blaming us.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And we can only hope that the virus and the lockdown pass as soon as possible, and that people are suitably freaked out by the authoritarian lurch of the rhetoric and the regime under which we are living. I want to move on now to a story that sounds like, it's dynamite, quite frankly, which is a shootout at a church. This was the International Pentecostal Church, and it has left, I think, 5 people dead, 40 people arrested. Sarah, what's going on?
No, you couldn't make this up. In fact, I'm just looking at the New York Times article on it. I mean, you know, that's how bizarre and unhelpful this event was. Basically, it's the International Pentecostal Holiness Church in Zierbekom, which is sort of in the near Carltonville. And on Saturday, 4 people were, and I quote, shot and burned to death in a car. A security guard was shot in another car. 6 other people were injured, and a whole lot of people were taken hostage in the church. Now, the photograph of the weaponry is extraordinary. I mean, you're looking at 2 bolt cutters, a baseball bat, about 6 clips of ammunition, 6 handguns, 4 semi-automatics, and a crowbar. I mean, it's I don't know. It's somewhere between a sort of country invasion and a cash in transit heist. And it appears that it's a leadership battle. And it's a large number of those arrested were members of the police, the army, and correctional services.
So wait, a leadership battle over what? Over the church?
Over the church. Yeah. I mean, you don't go and sort of present your credentials and pray and may the best man win. You shoot the hell out of everybody and see who's left standing, I guess. That's what it was. Apparently, a battle of leadership over the church. So, apparently, the police said there were actually more than 30 guns found. It's a feud between church members and their leaders, we couldn't make this stuff up.
It kind of seems like the sort of thing one would see in an action movie, or some sort of gangster film. But I was just saying in our talk before this that it seems to me as if these a lot of South Africa's churches are still very important in our society, particularly amongst poorer South Africans. Mm-hmm. They have huge numbers of attendees. Lots of people are very devoted to their churches and they go all the time. And control of the churches has extreme amounts of social prestige and potential economic activities related to them. So I really think that the media should do a better job of covering what exactly is going on in a lot of churches. And
absolutely. Because I'm assuming the people with the sort of an armory of this nature are not do not want to necessarily put the priority on getting closer to God. I suspect it's the coffers that are more of interest. And there is money in some. There is some churches, I mean, we've seen there is a huge amount of money and people get very rich off them. So I think the whole idea of churches having sort of NGO status and tax exemption, I know it has been looked at to some extent, but I think it has to be looked at a hell of a lot harder.
Yeah, I think part of the problem here, and Gabriel, I want your thoughts on this, is that one of the reasons that this stuff isn't covered that closely by the media is a lot of the journalists, especially who make up the sort of more widely published ranks of the South African media, are just not the sort of people who go to church. And that means that for them, this is kind of really out there, and it doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit within their sort of worldview or their cultural context. Do you think I'm right?
Yeah, I think that you are right. I think that our sort of academic elite tends to be very atheist. Although I'm hesitant to say atheist, because I think that there is a form of socialism that is religious, and there's a form of race nationalism that is religious. I think wokeism is a grand church, and not a particularly new one. There have been sort of wokest churches of one form or another under the title Volksgeist for at least the last 200 years. But there, and so sort of more traditional religious systems are, it's hard to know how to deal with them, especially because most South Africans are religious, and there's a sort of obvious cleavage between the elite and the common populace in that regard, and one that I think people are hesitant to do. It's just sort of unclear how one can comment on it without drawing too much attention to one's own difference. I think no one wants to be a Christopher Hitchens or a Richard Dawkins and sort of try and proselytize against religion. No. But at the same time, I think there's a deep discomfort with it. I mean, I should say there's another side to it, which is that I think in this country we have a, you know, in rural and poorer areas, South Africa is such a Wild West environment. And there's so many different language groups. There's so many different – it's quite hard to – I as a journalist would feel almost as strange if I were to drive out there and try and cover this. I might feel as alien as I would if I were to go to Botswana and try and cover a story there, because I don't really know what the local politics is. I don't really know what the story behind the story is. And I think because South Africa is so diverse, it's not just rich South African, poor South Africa, rural South African, urban South Africa. Each little pocket kind of does have its own norms. And so this is where one relies on a really deep base of journalists who, so that there is going to be someone who really is well-informed about a particular area who can then go and cover it. And then, you know, curious people, curious journalists who aren't as familiar, but who are then interested in echoing the story to give a national platform to it. And I suppose it's especially in that second regard where the problem really shines up. But it's not a new thing, you know. It's like I don't know, the People's War wasn't covered because it didn't fit the narrative. Lot of ANC assassinations don't really get covered because they don't really fit the narrative. You know, it takes like one of South Africa's biggest named journalists to publish a huge book to try and get people to draw their attention to that. And then it comes and then it goes. And then it just becomes like a thing we all vaguely know happens in the back of our minds.
Yeah.
We're disconnected from each other.
Sara, any final thoughts on this?
Just to say that I echo Gabriel in this, particularly in this sense, and that churches are by and large probably what stands between us and complete meltdown. They provide a lot of succor to their congregations. A lot of people's lives are structured around their church and around their teachings of their church. And in that sense, churches have an incredibly important place in a society where probably 80% of people who consider them Christians are probably churchgoers. And it's a crucial aspect to it. It's about kids having discipline, having being made to respect their parents. But then you get the real shysters in the game, who are either making a huge amount of money or are sort of treating their congregations with wildlife of a very distinct nature. And I know they've had an investigation into it, but I'm not entirely sure. I must admit, maybe I just lost interest, but I'm not entirely sure what came out of it. But I think people, South Africans deserve the issue to be looked at properly, so that the churches that serve them well remain, and the churches that just rip people off do not.
I think if by any chance anyone listening to this happens to be a member of this International Pentecostal Church that had this gun battle, and you actually know what's going on, submit it to the Daily Friend. Write something and submit it to the Daily Friend. It'd be fascinating.
I'd love to know. I mean, there is something almost comic about it, because it sounds so Wild West that it's hard to actually imagine. But on the other hand, it's clearly a tragedy, and it involves police and soldiers. Yeah, I want to know. I really want to know what's going on there.
Definitely. All right, for our last topic, which we will probably need to rush through as we are running a bit over time, I think, which is, Gabriel, you did a great service to the cause of liberty by reading through something that can't have been fun to read through, which was the inequality report. Tell us a bit about what it is and what it boils down to.
Well, it's 236 pages. And when I finished it, I definitely felt like a drink, which I now am not allowed to do, because that will make me a reckless murderer of all COVID patients. But it's basically a government report on wealth inequality. And this is another big narrative thing, right? It is true that when the storm blows through, all the people in the little rickety boats with holes in their sails are getting blown over. And people in nice big ironclad ships are more likely to weather the storm and then take advantage of whatever growth might be on offer to come. So that will exacerbate inequality. And South Africa famously has the greatest inequality in the world. But to get to, I mean, there's some interesting findings here that you can be sure are going to be covered elsewhere. I suppose I want to, because we're short on time, focus a little bit on what I don't think is going to be covered elsewhere. One of the things is that government can be hugely it can pat itself on the head for doing what it set out to do. From a frog boiler's point of view, this report is gleeful reading. White people have been impoverished in a way that it's just well done, I guess. The top 10% of white income earners of by expenditure, expenditure was, wait, hold, let's start with median expenditure. White median expenditure in 2011 was 110,000 rand per annum. Okay. That makes you, we know what the median is, right? It's like if you were to put all the white people in a row, the middle one is spending on average about 110,000 rand a year. And that came down to 100,000 rand by 2015. So I have looked at a lot of inequality tables. It's hard to find anywhere in the world where between 2011 and 2015, median expenditure went down by 10%. So that's racial justice, I suppose, in some way of looking at things. To make it more complicated, the source is listed above, but I've read through the full data table on the sourcing, and they don't make it clear whether this is inflation adjusted or not. But based on the other numbers on the table, it looks to me like it's not inflation adjusted, and that would mean that median expenditure went down by far more than 10%. I think that just is sort of contrary, and that's between 2011 and 2015. They don't have later data, but based on other publications, for example, New World Wealth, it looks like median expenditure would have gone down even further. So sort of, slowly but surely immiserating whites seems to be working. The other headline figure to point out is that in 2006, white expenditure was 45% of total expenditure. So you can sort of say, white people had 45% of the money, black South Africans had 41% of the money, colored South Africans 8%, Indian South Africans 4%. That has shifted. By 2015, black South Africans went up to 50%, 49 point something. White South Africans came down to 36%. So serious growth in the share of Black South Africans, and that would be, I mean, that is good news. It would be much better news if it wasn't because white people had gotten poorer. If it was like, you know, white people are still kind of growing at a slowish rate, and Black South Africans, because they're coming off such a low base, are just growing at a much faster rate and are now outspending white South Africans. That would be a much better story. That would be a sort of pro-growth story. But we're more into, you know, our government is more into a revanchist, like, take from one side and give to another side rather than sort of try and grow the whole pie attitude. But I think if you combine that figure that I've just given with another figure, then something even more interesting emerges. So they've got a breakdown of – they've got a couple of different breakdowns of wealth inequality within racial groups. And they find that white South Africans, the most like Sweden, it's the most even distribution. The bottom 10% of white South Africans are spending about 15% of the money that white South Africans spend. The middle 50% are spending about 50, 55% of the money. And then the top 10% are spending about 30% of the money. So that's very low inequality by global standards. By contrast, amongst Black South Africans, the bottom 10% on one of their measures are spending 7.2% of all of the money that Black people are spending. So that's half the bottom 10%, the bottom 40%. That's half of what the bottom 40% of white people are spending relative to all other white South Africans. The middle 50% of Black South Africans are spending 50% of the money, and then the top 10% are spending like 45, nearly 50% of all money that Black South Africans are spending. So there's huge inequality, and the top 10% is like the most dominant relative to its race group, top 10% of anywhere in South Africa and of anywhere in the world that I can find. And if you combine that with this earlier figure that I just cited, you find this. The top 10% of South Africans have roughly half of all of the money that Black South Africans have, and Black South Africans have roughly half of all the money that all South Africans have. And what falls out of that is that the top 10% of Black South Africans have a quarter of all of the money that South Africans have, whereas the top 10% of white people just have a third of all the money that white people have, and white people just have a third of all the money that the country has. So the top 10% of white people have a ninth of all the money that the country has. So if you compare a quarter to a ninth, that's something like 25% versus 10%, 9%. It's looking like the top 10% of Black South Africans are two, three, maybe four times as economically potent as the top 10% of white South Africans. Now, a kind of racialist might say, well, that's still not demographically representative because there's like seven or eight Black South Africans for every white South African. So the top 10% of Black South Africans should be seven or eight times more economically potent than the top 10% of white South Africans. But from the other point of view, from the political point of view, one of the reasons that people worry about inequality is that if you have a lot of money in few people's hands and they then use that money to drive politics through lobbying that creates laws that then crushes opposition and competition and artificially keeps them in place and keeps their children with advantages that they wouldn't otherwise have without sort of laws to hold them up, and patronage networks. That's the inequality worry, right? Is that money ends up corrupting government because the money is already so concentrated. So if you're going to look through a race lens, the lobby that you'd most worry about is the top 10% Black lobby, because it's at least two, maybe four times as strong as the top 10% white lobby. And what would you worry? Well, you'd worry that the Black elite, which has got the largest share of wealth in the country, at least by expenditure, is using a portion of that money to drive through laws that make it harder for Blacks, Indians, for white Indians and coloreds to compete, and for poor black people who aren't as connected to the patronage network or have the opportunities to go to the same kinds of private high schools and great universities to get in there. And that's exactly what we have with our BEE. So this inequality report, you have to get this finding. They don't spell this out themselves, because obviously it would alarm many readers. But it does seem to provide pretty solid evidence, as New World Wealth found, that there are more black dollar millionaires than white dollar millionaires in 2015. But this seems to suggest that it's even starker than that. And I think that people should think about this very seriously. How can you have BEE in a country where the richest group is the top 10 black percent? It just seems like the kind of thing you can be damn sure is not going to be written about in Business Day or the Financial Mail or IOL, but it seems important.
It does really seem to confirm kind of what we've been saying, is that there is this predatory elite that has, or not entirely predatory elite, but
no, a lot of guys are great entrepreneurs, but a lot of guys are not. Yeah.
But a lot of guys are not. And these people are actually making it pretty good. But overall, BEE has not lifted up a lot of people. It's really exacerbated a lot of the inequality problems that it sort of served to fix. And it also has kind of chased away whites. Which is
Not ideal and as well. Skills
and money and skills and all these other good trust. Things. Yeah. So yet another nail in what should have been the coffin of BE, but unfortunately not quite. Anyway, I think we have gone a bit over now, so we have to call it to a close. Thank you everyone for listening. Thanks Sarah and Gabriel for coming on the show today. If you like what you heard here, if you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, the alternative media voice we provide, the analysis we do, and the policy research and campaigns that we run, you can become a friend of the Institute by going to irr.org.za.